Hello. Welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Stuart Young about his new book, Conceiving the Indian Buddhist Patriarchs in China, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2015 as part of the Kuroda Institute Studies in East Asian Buddhism series. In this book, Young examines Chinese hagiographic representations of three Indian Buddhist patriarchs, Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva, from the early 5th to late 10th centuries, and explores the role that these representations played in the development of Chinese Buddhism's self-awareness of its own position within Buddhist history, and of its growing confidence that Buddhism could flourish in China despite the distance between the Middle Kingdom and the land of the Buddha. On the one hand, this project traces these three legendary figures as they are portrayed first as exemplars of how to revive the Dharma in a world without a Buddha, then as representatives of a lineage stretching back to Shakyamuni, and finally as scholar types who transmitted the Dharma to China via their exegetical and doctrinal works. More broadly, however, Young uses this transformation as an index of changing views of medieval China's relationship to Shakyamuni's India, and of Chinese Buddhists' confidence in their own ability to realize the Buddhist soteriological path and firmly establish the Indian tradition on Chinese soil. One theme running throughout the book is the way in which these three patriarchs bridge the Sino-Indian divide. This was particularly important for those Chinese Buddhists who were unsettled by the geographical and historical distance that separated them from the India of Shakyamuni's time. The Chinese found Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva particularly attractive because while their Indian origins lent them authority, they were, like the Chinese who peered down the well of history at them, living in a time without a Buddha, and thus faced a dilemma not so dissimilar from the predicament in which medieval Chinese found themselves. Unlike the Arhats, who experienced Shakyamuni's ministry firsthand, and unlike the celestial bodhisattvas, who were not bound by history, these three Indian patriarchs occupied a temporal position between Shakyamuni's India and medieval China. In addition, as Young shows, the Chinese attributed qualities to and highlighted aspects of these Indian patriarchs that were in accord with the values of the Chinese literati, Buddhist and otherwise. In so doing, the Chinese rendered the Indian patriarchs familiar and made them into models that Chinese literati could realistically and willingly emulate. This point is related to another theme linking the chapters together, the Chinese Buddhist appropriation of Indian Buddhist and Chinese religious elements so as to claim them as their own. Young notes, however, that even as the patriarchs developed into models to be emulated, they were also transformed into objects of veneration. Besides being scholarly types who sat around writing doctrinal treaties, Nagarjuna came to be associated with Pure Land thought and practice, and even had his own Pure Land, according to some, and was worshipped for his apotropaic powers and ability to provide this-worldly benefits, while Ashvaghosha became a silkworm deity and served as a protagonist in myths that provided a Buddhist justification for the killing of silkworms. And in a final chapter, Young shows how Buddhists co-opted Chinese conceptions of sanctity and sainthood so as to show that these qualities that were in reality of Chinese provenance were in fact Indian and Buddhist through and through. Readers will thus learn not only the details of Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva's Chinese careers over a 5.5-century period, but also the way in which these careers reflected changing Chinese conceptions of Buddhist history and of China's own position within that history. The book will be of particular interest to those researching Chinese perceptions of India, religious aspects of Chinese sericulture, and East Asian conceptions of Buddhist history and transmission. However, addressing broad themes as it does, Young's work will also prove useful to those studying the way in which a tradition negotiates its relationship with its origins when those origins are at great geographical, historical, and cultural remove. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'm with Stuart Young, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Bucknell University, and we're going to be discussing his recent book, Conceiving the Indian Buddhist Patriarchs in China, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2015. Stuart, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks very much, Luke. I'm honored to be part of the show.
No, the pleasure's mine. As is usual, I wonder if you could just begin by the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you came to the study of China and or Buddhism.
Sure. I'm originally from Southern California. I was born and raised in a small town called South Pasadena. went to college there also in Southern California and at Claremont McKenna College. And I suppose I would say that's the place where I first, I don't know if really had exposure to Buddhism, but certainly first became interested in it. I was a philosophy major almost from the start, from my freshman year in college, basically because that was all that interested me. Mm. And so I just took as many philosophy courses as the registrar would allow me and got some pretty broad exposure to a lot of things, you know, especially continental philosophy. I was interested in religious mysticism for one, existentialism and so on. At the time, you know, this was like the mid-90s, and they didn't really have there at Claremont, as far as I recall, not any courses at all that were related to Buddhism. I suppose they might have had Chinese language, but at the time I didn't even know any kind of curricular entree into China at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up just kind of working independently with the guy who was my mentor, a professor, you know, an older guy, even at the time, Frederick Sontag, who was at Pomona College. And he really was one of the most influential figures in, you know, my kind of early attempts to be academic, though in philosophy. And so he allowed me to do an independent study with him about Buddhism and, you know, just reading a bunch of books. I remember, you know, like Zen and the Art of Archery and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And,
mm-hmm.
Some DT Suzuki stuff and whatnot, and all stuff that I basically just found on my own. And in fact, I don't even remember how I first got, a Buddhist book or first heard anything about it because there wasn't any class. But anyway, I got interested in that side of things. And, those were the philosophies that as an undergraduate Buddhist philosophy that struck me as, most interesting, most compelling. That's what I really wanted to kind of follow up on, and I ended up being able to do my undergraduate senior thesis with Fred Sontag directing it on a kind of a comparison of medieval Christian mysticism, Neoplatonism, and then some presentations of Zen. I think I was working with maybe Shunryu Suzuki.
Mm-hmm.
And Tibetan Buddhism with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and some ideals that I thought in that overlapped with the stuff in Zen and with the other Western traditions. So that's kind of how I first got into Buddhist studies, was through that work in undergrad as a philosophy major. I kept it up except for the philosophy side, which I would not say I've disavowed, but I have my work is not philosophical work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Thanks for that. So how then did you go from that and come eventually to focus specifically on the topic of this book?
Well, so it's actually this topic for this book has really, well, was, I suppose, finally it's done. It was in the works for me for almost my entire career in Buddhist studies, really. I mean, I began with it really... so it's a longer story than I've already given you with my background. But after I graduated from college, you know, as a philosophy major, I didn't get any jobs. And so, being interested in Buddhism, I thought the first thing I should do is go to Asia, which is what I did after I graduated. I just got a job teaching English in South Korea, and I moved there, and I lived in South Korea by myself for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I still kind of wanted to get back into academia, and I always kind of had aspired to be a professor. So I got back to the States and after a year abroad, and I just started taking courses then in Buddhism at UCLA. It was not a degree program, but just kind of open enrollment. Anyone in Southern California could just show up and take a class and pay for it by class. And so that's what I did.
Hmm.
I took my first Buddhism class was, formal Buddhism class was with James Benn at UCLA when, you know, he was a grad student there finishing his PhD. And, this was probably like, 2000 or I mean, maybe 1999 or 8 or something.
Mm.
And then James has, I should take this opportunity to say that James has certainly been the most influential person in my development as a scholar in Buddhist studies. He's really been my greatest mentor and friend for coming near on 2 decades now.
Hmm.
Reading everything I've written and just being the most amazing friend and advisor, really, that anyone could hope for. I have nothing but the greatest respect for James. So the story goes on. I started taking classes there at UCLA with James, and I had a class with David Skaberg, which was great, on Chinese thought, philosophy, and this gets around to how I got into this project. Another course that I took there was with Gregory Chopin.
Yeah.
So that's where I got into. I started working on Nargarjuna. I randomly in that class with Greg Chopin ran across. I guess it was Nargarjuna-Konda, in the kind of Indian archaeological context.
Mm-hmm.
And, I figured, well, here I am with this philosophy background. I'm interested in philosophy. So if I'm going to get into Buddhism, I should study Nargarjuna. He's the greatest Buddhist philosopher ever, as far as everyone typically represents him.
Yes.
I'm interested in Nargarjuna sort of from the philosophical side with my background undergraduate. And then I'm in this class with Greg Chopin looking at archaeological evidence from India. And that's where the first kind of, my first sort of entree into this started with this discrepancy between the predominance of Nargarjuna in literature,
mm-hmm.
in philosophical writings and so on. But then the absolute absence, the complete absence of any reference to Nargarjuna in all of these donative inscriptions around Nargarjuna-Konda and Amaravati and other Indian sites that we were working on in this class with Greg Chopin. And so that was my first. And so I'm looking at all. I start getting into all these materials about Nargarjuna, and that's really where I where I started this whole project and my career in Buddhist studies was studying Nargarjuna.
Mm-hmm.
Then this led me to the hagiographies of Nargarjuna, which exist actually predominantly in Chinese language. Of course, at that time, I'm reading everything in English translation.
Yes.
But that's when it struck me that there's all these hagiographic accounts about Nargarjuna that were produced in China, and all of the scholarship that I'm reading out there about Nargarjuna is using all of these Chinese hagiographic materials. And all of the scholarship is doing so primarily in an effort to locate Nargarjuna in the Indian context, in Indian history, Indian philosophy, and so on. And that kind of struck me at the outset as a notable contradiction methodologically. Why are we using these Chinese sources to study India? and that was sort of the seed that begat the whole book, which was, well, let's look at these same Chinese sources that everyone's long used to situate Nargarjuna in ancient India. Well, why don't we look at these Chinese sources to ask and then try to answer questions about what they meant to the Chinese people who were, I don't know if authoring them, but at least circulating them. This is the most abundant body of hagiographic literature about Nargarjuna in any Buddhist context. It's the earliest by centuries in any Buddhist context. So it just seemed to me to be the most straightforward kind of proposition to start examining those hagiographic sources in the context in which they first circulated in medieval China.
Yes.
So then that led to a master's thesis. I went on and got a master's degree at SOAS in the University of London. And
yeah.
Master's thesis was that. It was looking at Nargarjuna specifically and trying to tease out some of the implications of those Chinese sources in their Chinese settings. And then this goes on to then become the, I followed along with it for the PhD dissertation at Princeton with Buzzy Tizer then, who was, kind of the next really influential, person for me in developing all this stuff and, taking courses with Buzzy and working together with him and developing this into a really, really a feasible, PhD research topic and then broadening it to include lots of other aspects and then especially to include, Ashwagosha and Arayadeva with Nargarjuna, given that he's come to be seen as kind of a triad in a lot of the medieval Chinese sources that I was looking at.
I see.
So that's a long story that's still long. That's basically how I got into this project, and it's carried me all the way through to its publication this year.
Okay. Wow. So yeah. So that. You, now, in this book, or in the introduction to the book, you lay out the theoretical groundwork upon which the subsequent six chapters rest and introduce us to the book's central themes. We'll get into more detail about this when we discuss the individual chapters, but I just wanted to begin with a few of those central themes. First, I just want to make it clear to listeners that you're focusing on the hagiographic imagery of the three Indian patriarchs as it existed and functioned in Chinese religion and culture between the early 5th and late 10th centuries. Now, as you mentioned, these three patriarchs are Ashvaghosha, the 2nd century author of the Buddhacharita and putative author of the Awakening of Faith, though, of course, it seems he's not, Nagarjuna, and then Aryadeva. Now, you've already mentioned how your monograph here differs from previous scholarship, namely that you're looking at sort of the Chinese images of these three rather than looking at their sort of using Chinese works to place them in a sort of Indian doctrinal, intellectual, historical context.
Right.
Before we get into the chapters, I just want to mention that in the introduction, one aspect of the book that you discuss is your approach to religious biography or hagiography, and you describe two standard ways of approaching religious hagiography, and you find both problematic. So I was wondering if you could just tell us what these two approaches are, why they're problematic, and how you want to depart from that.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, traditionally we have the approaches to hagiography whereby you see them as an amalgam of a real historical event that occurred. And then the mythic accretions that build up over time upon that historical event. Those mythic accretions are added for various didactic purposes, as traditionally understood. And then mm-hmm. So the approach is to try to peel back those layers of accreted myth such that we can recover the actual historical events that occur, this sort of positivist historicist project. And that's one primary use, at least traditionally, I think, though no one really tries to do this so much anymore.
Yeah.
One side of that equation then is, trying to get rid of that myth to see what the real historical reality is underlying it.
Right.
And then the other side of that coin is, let's look at the myth then as a product of a particular kind of, social, cultural, religious context, and using the myths then to tease out the realities of that context.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my work is trying to do is just basically transcend this myth history dichotomy, really, and try not to focus on what is historical, what is mythic, or what is true and what is false. What is a pre-narrative historical event and what is later narrative accretion. And all those dichotomies seem to me to be false, and not to me, of course. I'm drawing on now a fairly long tradition of scholarship on hagiography, mm-hmm. at least in the past decade, or probably past couple of decades, that has similarly decried this false dichotomy. And in fact, here really, my greatest influence is certainly the recent work of Rob Campany, who was also very kind to review an earlier version of my manuscript, my book. But Rob's work is just, to me, this is still the definitive statement about hagiography as a record of social discourses.
Mm-hmm.
By which, so this is his way, which is a nice way of, again, transcending this myth-history dichotomy, this false dichotomy that's been imposed upon the genre.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really just trying to kind of follow in Rob's footsteps, really, in that regard. I've added a little touch, I suppose, of incorporating Jonathan Lyons' discussion of the ancient model of the exemplum, which I won't describe in too much depth now, except to say that it's there in the book. It's basically trying to do the same thing that Rob Campany does in that it's treating hagiography as a record of a kind of a social discourse, and using hagiography then to get at the contours of this social discourse. In my particular case, I think this discourse revolves largely around what Buddhist sainthood was in medieval China, particularly in regard to its perceived ancient Indian precedents, given that these are all Indian masters that are being memorialized in these texts.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one move I try to make about hagiography is as treating it as exemplum, which again I think follows closely along the lines of Rob Campany's work, is on hagiography as a record of social discourse. A couple other moves I try to make concerning hagiography that are a little bit different than what Rob does. I mean, first of all, because I'm dealing with what are seen to be Indian sources, I don't try to weigh in really on whether they are Indian sources. We don't have any evidence to know.
Yeah.
You know, so at the Chinese sources we've got, you know, maybe they circulated to India. Maybe they were invented in China. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, because they're seen to be from India in China, and that's pretty widespread. I mean, I don't think anyone's questioning typically the authenticity, the Indian authenticity. I guess just to be clear, the Chinese are typically not questioning the Indian authenticity of these texts. They are taking them as Indian accounts.
Yes.
And so therefore, I feel like they need to be treated a little bit differently in terms of how we interpret the genre in the Chinese context, right? I mean, these are seen to be Indian texts in China. Therefore, for the Chinese, they're not expected to share the same kind of conventions as all, you know, there's of course many, many other genres of, you know, native Chinese genres of hagiography, you know, built on imperial dynastic histories and such, which Campy describes a lot in his book on the Shenxian Zhuang, the traditions of the transcendent. But because these are seen as Indian, I feel like they need to be treated a little bit differently from the standpoint of our analysis, and I try to make that move then to look at my particular hagiographic sources as unique amongst hagiographic sources in China, given that their focus is on validly integrating Indian models of Buddhist sainthood into a Chinese context. And that, I think, makes them a little bit different than native Chinese genres of hagiography. And then the last move I'm trying to make about hagiography that I think, you know, is relatively new. I don't know if that I've seen this discussion made elsewhere, but that hagiography really isn't the kind of, or it often isn't the kind of discrete genre of religious literature that it's often made out to be. I mean, you know, if you were to come up with a thumbnail sketch definition of what hagiography is, it's the written biographies of saints.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good, and that's, yeah, I don't mean to say that that's wrong, but I also want to emphasize in the book that hagiography really ties in with all other genres of Buddhist literature as well, with sutra, shastra, ritual manuals. There are degrees to which hagiographic representations and doctrinal discussions and ritual representations and uses all really clearly overlap. And so, you know, I'm trying to kind of illustrate how hagiography really sort of fit into all of these other genres and all these other, I guess, modes of discourse and practice amongst Buddhists.
Okay.
So anyway, that's sort of the things I'm trying to say about hagiography in the book.
Great, thanks. So the book comprises six chapters, and the first three chapters trace the they proceed chronologically, tracing the transformation of these three Indian patriarchs. So beginning with the first chapter, here you turn to the earliest textual depictions of Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva, and also to early Chinese understandings of what happened to Buddhism in India after the death of the Buddha. And one of the problems you mention here that early Chinese Buddhists faced was how to go about following the Buddhist path in the absence of a Buddha. So here you argue that Chinese ecclesiastics, and you focus on three Chinese exegetes in particular, saw these Indian patriarchs as being able to revive the Dharma in the face of seemingly inevitable decline. And you argue that these Chinese monks, believed that the Indian patriarchs did this, were able to do this through engaging in activities that happened to be those highly valued by Chinese literati of the time. So there's
right,
some sort
right.
of retrospective sort of projection going on here. Now that's sort of my, and in so doing that, they sort of created these models that they could actually realistically follow themselves. But that's my inarticulate summary of the chapter's argument. I was wondering if you could take us through this, beginning with the problem of Buddha's absence, and then moving on to the way in which these three Indian patriarchs presented themselves as a possible solution to the problem of medieval Chinese monks' geographical and historical distance from ancient India, And then finally, just mention some of the qualities of Chinese literati that Chinese monks attributed to these three Indian patriarchs.
Right, right. Well, I mean, this—I guess this was one of my my answers early on. You know, as I'm imagining this project in the dissertation stages and so on, of why are these particular patriarchs so important? You know, why are they so widely represented? Why are they all over the place in Chinese Buddhist sources? And in this chapter, I think the answer to this largely comes to be that, well, it's because there's so much like the Chinese authors who are promoting them. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, for one, in this, as you mentioned, this issue of kind of this dharmic historical moment. You know, we're far removed from the Buddha. The Dharma is on the decline. There's all kinds of horrible things happening all around us that we can readily observe, and we're trying to uphold the Dharma at a remove from the epicenter of enlightenment, and at a remove from India, and you know, how do we go about doing this? And this becomes a, you know, it seems to be a fairly common concern expressed amongst you know, early 5th century Chinese Buddhists, and even earlier. I guess in the book I mentioned from the time of Dao'an, the 4th century seems to come to the fore. But, you know, this issue of, like, how to maintain fidelity to original, pure, true Buddhism when we're so far away from the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this strikes me as one reason why this particular triad of patriarchs at that time, so early 5th century, right, this is the time when Pumarajiva arrives in China. One reason why these particular Indian patriarchs seem to offer such compelling examples for Chinese adepts of the time, because these Indian patriarchs lived in a very similar kind of they had a very similar kind of plight. You know, they're centuries removed, as these early hagiographic statements make clear.
Mm-hmm.
The Indian patriarchs themselves are centuries removed from the Buddha at a time when his teachings are fallen into decay. And so, you know, what do they do in that circumstance? How do they go about righting the ship? And this is, you know, again, why I think they seem to be so compelling for Chinese Buddhists at the time, who see themselves as in very similar circumstances. And then, yeah, right, so then how do they go about righting the ship? Well, you know, they do so in these early, so this is the sort of the earliest strata of the Chinese hagiographic literature about these Indian figures. It appears almost entirely in prefaces to the works that were translated by Kumarajiva, the works of Nagarjuna Ashvaghosha Rayadeva.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the earliest strata all depicts the Indian patriarchs, you know, in these little preface biographical accounts. You know, the patriarchs are saving the world when it's about to collapse by writing texts,
mm-hmm.
by, you know, doctrinal authorship, a certain degree of kind of remove, like, you know, kind of hermetic remove from worldly affairs, through oral debate, through public oral debate against heretical masters, and by promoting methods of seated contemplation, meditation, and so these are the repertoire of practices that are just always associated with the patriarchs in these early Chinese sources, and then so it strikes me, okay, well. These prefaces are written by the most the elite of the elite of the Chinese monastic community of the time. You know, these are elite literati scholars who are as well versed as anyone in all of the traditional Chinese literature and in Buddhist literature as transmitted by Kumarajiva and for, you know, a couple of centuries before him. So it strikes me that, you know, they're presenting images of these Indian patriarchs in a historical context, which is very much like their own,
mm-hmm.
and performing practices, which are very much like those practices esteemed by figures like Sung Rei, Sung Zhao, and Hui Yuan, you know, the disciples of Kumarajiva.
Yes.
So, you know, you begin to look more and more like, you know, a figure like Sung Rei is basically presenting himself in ancient India, as, you know, as equivalent to a figure like Nagarjuna, saving the world when it's about to collapse by writing treatises, by performing, you know, the kind of Buddhist practice that a scholar performs.
I see.
So then I guess the next step of the analysis, which I thought maybe was useful, was that what does it do? I mean, it makes that kind of scholarly model, kind of spiritual scholarship, which wasn't just a Buddhist, you know, these kind of preoccupations that I mentioned are not just Buddhist at the time in China. Of course, they're shared by, all religious adepts across traditions. So in this chapter, I kind of try to emphasize the competition, competitive aspect between figures like Sung Rei and Sung Jiao, these elite literati Buddhist masters, competition between them and other Chinese traditions of kind of scholarly religiosity, like Shen Shui, study of the profound, adepts of the time, or practitioners of Qingtan, or a pure conversation, you know, which would incorporate Taoist classics and other kind of native Chinese religious traditions. So I'm seeing, you know, these Buddhist authors basically projecting all of the most important practices of the Chinese literati religious elite. They're projecting all of these practices back into ancient India. And so, you know, I think one way to interpret this might be, that therefore they're, expressly working to Indianize and therefore Buddhistize practices like public debate, treatise authorship, meditation, and eremitism. Mm-hmm. And therefore kind of making these things Buddhist, making these things Indian, and therefore claiming kind of a certain sovereignty over those practices, then claiming themselves as the representatives of Buddhism, as the sort of the rightful champions of those practices, the rightful users of public debate. So anyone who's doing public debate, not for the purpose of propagating Buddhism, is just spinning their wheels and only really works and is only really effective and right if it's done in the service of the Buddhist truth, because, of course, it has its ancient Indian heritage, as demonstrated by Ashvaghosha, Nargajna, and Narayadeva.
Yes.
That might be kind of a convoluted way to put the argument, but that's how I see kind of India coming into play here and being used to legitimize, authorize Buddhist practitioners above and against other Chinese religious traditions in this kind of competitive religious environment.
Which leads us into a point you make at the end of the chapter, but which is extremely important for the entire book and which is central to many of your arguments, which is that the Indianness of these three was both de-emphasized and emphasized. So, what you just said slightly explains that. But could you just more pointedly emphasize why it was important that they were both Indian and yet not too Indian?
Yeah. So, right, you would. Not too Indian, I guess, to start with that side of it. They are, as I see them, intended to be exemplars, intended to be models of emulation at this point. And so I suppose that from that standpoint, from, perspective of a figure like Hui Yuan, what was more important is what they shared. Mm-hmm. That is the Indian patriarchs and their Chinese proponents. And what they shared was this temporal remove from the Buddha. From that standpoint, then it wasn't so important that the Sino-Indian divide there wasn't as crucial. What was more important to emphasize was the fact that they shared a plight. Their plights were accordant across that Sino-Indian divide of being, being removed in time from the epicenter, when Buddhism flourished. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, it seemed to be kind of downplayed that Indianness. But on the other hand, at the same time, they were clearly in their hagiographic accounts situated in India. They're called Indian masters. I mean, still clearly they are Indian. And I think that, well, that served a certain kind of function, that Indianness. Provides them with a certain cachet. It provides them with authority. And then again, the next step of the argument, which I think is somewhat different than what I've heard elsewhere anyway, but that Indian identity serves as a means by which Chinese Buddhists can then make the practices that they champion, which are also shared across all Chinese religious traditions, they can make those practices quintessentially Buddhist and Indian, and kind of use that Indian identity to make things that otherwise would have been seen as traditional Chinese, mm-hmm. to make those things Indian.
Yes.
To kind of Buddhicize them and therefore claim a kind of sovereignty over them.
Mm. Great. So the works that you discuss in chapter one all depict these three Indian patriarchs as prevailing and saving the Dharma despite the state of the world in which they find themselves. And another thing you point out is that in these depictions, they're all sort of self-made men of sorts, and that they single-handedly revive a Dharma in decline.
Right.
And that's obviously one of the aspects that makes these, you know, later Chinese sort of be able to identify with them, because they're both sort of living in a world without a Buddha.
Right.
Now, in chapter two, you turn to a subsequent development in which Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva are portrayed instead as standing in a lineage of patriarchs that stretches back to Shakyamuni and through which the teachings have been transmitted without any sort of decline.
Right.
Now, this is a very rich chapter, and it's not easy to summarize, and I won't try, so listeners will have to read it themselves in order to appreciate the complexity of your argument, the developments that you discuss, as well as to read your own analyses of the primary sources. But I want to begin here with I just want to kind of go over the two main primary sources for this chapter. The first is the 5th or 6th century Dharma treasury transmission, and the other is the 6th century, I believe, cave of great perduring saints. And in your study, these two primary sources represent two stages in the development not only of Chinese understandings of the Indian patriarchs, but also of China's relationship to Shakyamuni's India and Chinese ideas about the possibility of following the Buddhist path in a world without a Buddha.
Yeah.
So I wanted to begin with the first one, the Dharma Treasury of Transmission, which is central not only to this chapter, but also to other aspects of your book. So what is it? And how does its description of Indian lineages differ from previous descriptions? And what's its role in your larger argument?
Right. So the Dharma Treasury Transmission, it's the Fufa Zhang Zhuan, Chinese text composed probably in China, though it does claim to be based on an Indian, various versions of it in some ways claim to be based on earlier Indian sources, claims to be a translation and so on. And it basically recounts a lineage of the Buddha Dharma from Shakyamuni, you know, through Mahakashyapa and the various patriarchs on down the line, 24 of them, or 23, 24, depending on versions and so on. And it includes the three that I'm focusing on in this study and that Kumarajiva had focused on from a century before. What's unique about this text, what's important about this text, why it's garnered so much attention, well, one reason why is that it kills the lineage. So this is the chapter of title two, or title of chapter two of my book, An Indian Lineage Severed. The text concludes, well, it doesn't quite conclude, but depicts the severance of this Dharma lineage with the last patriarch, Bhikshu Sima, at the hands of an unsympathetic king who cuts his head off.
In Kashmir.
Yeah, in Kashmir. And that's the end of the lineage. There's various ways in which this has been interpreted. It's about imperial persecution. Of course, it's very foreboding and apocalyptic, of course, because, you know, the lineage is dead. And then the text will go on to say how, you know, we're all screwed and there's no more saints and the Dharma's going to die. But then what's interesting about this text is then how it eventually does finally conclude, which is to go on to say, after it's killed off the last patriarch and said how the Dharma is going to die, then it goes on to say, well, hey, all you really need to do is work hard and everything will be okay. The Dharma will continue to thrive if everyone, picks themselves up by their bootstraps and really bears down and perseveres and propagates the Dharma. Well, I'll be okay. So this kind of conflicting agendas has been a topic of some conversation in the scholarship, and Elizabeth Morrison has dealt with it very well, and Wendy Adamek, a couple of the scholars I've been kind of discussing this with in writing and elsewhere. I guess what I'm trying to say about it, a few things. you know, one that it's really actually not as foreboding as it might seem there with the end, talking about the decline of the Dharma and the patriarchate being severed. And in that way, it really fits in with many other Buddhist eschatological writings of its time. It's really very akin to a lot of other sources of that genre, the Chandragarbha Sutra, Chinese versions of the Chandragarbha Sutra, the Mahamaya Sutra, which are produced in a similar time. And so it really fits more into that context of early medieval Chinese Buddhist eschatology than it does with later Buddhist lineage histories in the Chan and the Tiantai traditions, which draw on it heavily. Mm-hmm. And I argue in this chapter that by doing so, really what they're doing is creating completely different kinds of texts. You know, a Chan lineage history that traces the transmission of the Dharma from Shakyamuni down to, you know, Huainan or whoever, that's a very different kind of text than what the Dharma Treasury transmission, as I argue, was intended to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't intended to legitimize local authorities by connecting them genealogically with the Buddha. So one thing I argue that I think is somewhat unique is that what it was perhaps intending to do was to instantiate a kind of a Lotus Sutra soteriology of absence. Which is to say, you know, what the Lotus Sutra, you know, kind of offers its explanation as to why the Buddha pretended to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the idea is basically, well, if self-reliance, if the Buddha isn't here to pick you up all the time, you learn how to pick yourself up. And I feel like the Dharma Treasury transmission tries to make a similar move. The absence of the Indian patriarchs will be your salvation, not their continuing presence.
So,
right. That's the idea of the soteriology of absence.
Mm-hmm.
So I presented on this in a conference in Taiwan last summer, and Bob Sharp was my respondent.
Mm-hmm.
I should also give props to Bob here while I'm talking. He's been a more distant but also a great influence on my work. In the few times that I've talked to him, he's always been very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, he was... less amenable to the idea of the Lotus Sutra soteriology being central to the Dharma Treasury transmission, largely because, of course, in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha never really leaves.
Yeah.
Which is a point well taken. And I guess, so what I see happening, and then this ties into the next source and that you brought up, which is central to this chapter, and this is the Cave of Great Perduring Saints,
mm-hmm.
Daju Shengku, which is completed in the year 589. When the Sui dynasty, it's got imperial sway and imperial patronage, and this is the year that the Sui dynasty finally unifies southern China, the last of the northern and southern dynasties, the Chen dynasty. At this time, and you know, this cave is constructed. You know, we can talk more if you like about what I'm making of the cave in that respect. But getting back to this Lotus Sutra soteriology idea, I think what the cave also does is brings those patriarchs back in a similar way to, and maybe a more similar way to how the Lotus Sutra both promotes that idea of that soteriology of absence and the upaya of the Buddha's nirvana, combining that then with his eternal presence.
Mm.
And then I kind of see the Dharma Treasury transmission and the cave in which it's carved as then combining to form a similar kind of dynamic as to how the Indian patriarchs are perceived.
So here you talk about the in the cave, and specifically it's a stele that depicts the 24 Indian patriarchs within the cave, or at the entrance to the cave, I guess.
Right.
You argue that this sort of presents them as being imminent.
Yeah, that's it's been a tricky part of my argument to develop. The listeners might be interested to know, and you too, of course. This was one of the major sticking points with the my readers for the press for Kuroda in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
I suppose maybe sticking point is too strong a way to put it. They were very positive overall about the book, but this is one area of the argument that I had to work on more.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I was, and that's to say that they were curious, maybe even as far as skeptical and disbelieving of my ideas that the patriarchs were actually seen as imminent mm-hmm. in this place.
Right. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, we'll go on. But I should mention to listeners that if you get your hands on the book, it did come off to me as one of the slightly more speculative aspects of the book. But it was a very rich description of the cave and how the whole sort of cave works as a sort of whole with these different components that represent different sort of messages about, you know, Buddhism and Buddhist soteriology.
Yeah, thanks. And you're right. It is speculative, and that's been my my response to in the revisions. Then in response to the readers, I try to emphasize more that speculative nature of the argument, because I don't know really what the Stele was doing there, and that's been part of my thinking for a couple of years about this is why is that Stele in there and what's it doing.
Yes.
Then I'm trying to posit potentially anyway, and again, this is speculation, but maybe it was used in some kind of a ritual program in the cave. Some evidence seems to indicate that, but anyway, in the interest of time, we can move forward if you like.
Well, there are plenty of parts of the book that aren't speculative at all, so I think you're probably allowed speculative part two. Anyway, but so going on, so the last chapter three is sort of the last of the first of this three chapter section. Well, you don't set it up as a section, but I kind of see it as a section where you trace the development of these three patriarchs. And here you continue with you talk about the localization of these Indian patriarchs within a larger trend that you describe as an effort to redefine China as the epicenter of Buddhist enlightenment.
Right.
And in this chapter, you focus on exegetical works from the 7th to 9th centuries that depict the Indian patriarchs transmitting Buddhism not through Vinaya and not through master-disciple lineages, as you discuss in Chapter 2, but rather through the composition of doctrinal treaties. And you... So I was wondering if you could just discuss the shift whereby the Chinese began to see China as a place of soteriological potential rather than a backwater. And also, could you also address this shift whereby Chinese commentators of the 6th to 8th centuries came to emphasize the three Indian patriarchs as exegetes who transmitted Buddhism through doctrine and treaties? And you mentioned this in the book, that this is the sort of... this is the image of these three that has come down to us even today. It's more of these sort of doctrinally focused exegetes.
Whereas
the other aspects of them, Ashvaghosha is a silkworm deity, for example, many of these things, even though they're very prevalent in China, that image hasn't been passed down in the same way.
Right. Yeah, it's a trend that really begins with Kumarajiva, and the sources discussed in the first chapter of the book, whereby these patriarchs are presented predominantly as doctrinal authors and scholars. And then this is the, it's really taken up and developed then in the Sui and the Tang period by figures like Jizang and Guanding, especially that these figures are, first and foremost, doctrinal authors. And of course, you have the Chinese monks who are presenting these images themselves are doctrinal authors, so it makes sense that they would try to emphasize these particular aspects of the patriarch's careers and achievements over others. And then, of course, you have the writings of a Jizang, for example, are then picked up in later Japanese Buddhist traditions and in Japanese scholarship. All of which have come to really influence Western scholarship on these figures, and so therefore that's, I guess, the predominant mode of or the predominant representation of these characters that's come down to us today through all those channels. Really beginning with Kumarajiva's disciples, but then I think especially Jizang is very influential in the Japanese tradition and in China in his own time, and is a very prolific author and really champions these patriarchs as models of enlightenment through scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Stepping back a little bit, then the context in which then I situate these writings, of a Jizang or a Guanding, is in an imperial Chinese context, and I suppose that's where typically these kinds of analyses begin, right, whereby, you know, why did China come to see itself as a center of civilization rather than a hinterland relative to India? Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the place to begin with answering that question is at the imperial level. You know, you have the reunification of China with the Sui and the Tang, and, you know, very, very powerful central dynasties established. And you know, some then more of a confidence in Chinese civilization, at least relative to the Six Dynasties period preceding. And then in the writings of imperial sponsors as well, you see these Indian patriarchs, these particular Indian patriarchs, arising and being represented. Let's see. Where remind me with the rest of your question. Where else should I go with this?
Right. Well, I guess you give three specific examples of how these Indian patriarchs were presented as exegetes, and I don't think listeners will have to go read the chapter for themselves to get the details there. But, I mean, could you speak more broadly to how these portrayals as of these Indian patriarchs as, you know, not as necessarily spell work, people in possession of apotropaic powers and so forth, how did their image as exegetes, as producers of doctrinal commentaries, how did that particular image of them function to render China an ideal place for Buddhist practice and flourishing?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I guess the basic argument there in the chapter is that the Indian patriarchs come to be seen as providing models of scholarship that and models of doctrinal authorship that are localized in the Chinese context, right? So the patriarch's treatises are here now in China, so no need to go back to India. The patriarch's models of how to elucidate the Dharma in doctrinal discourse, those models of scholarly production, are now here in China. So no need to go back, you know, to the Indian heartland anymore. In fact, now China is the heartland. China is the land where the bodhisattvas dwell. China is the land where relics have been distributed all across the land, and where emperors are themselves Buddhas incarnate. So I see the representations of the patriarchs and their writings and their models of scholarship then fitting into this broader context of all these ways in which Chinese Buddhist authors and Chinese imperial patrons are attempting to make then Buddhism as the center, or China as the center of Buddhist civilization.
Sure.
And then three specific ways. I won't go into too much depth here, but that occurs is right through Guanding's writings, what I'm basically arguing there is that he's equating his master Zhiyi with Nagarjuna. You know, he's basically saying that Zhiyi is the Chinese Nagarjuna. Zhiyi's magnum opus, the Great Calming and Contemplation, is the Chinese version of Nagarjuna's Great Perfection of Wisdom treatise.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't rely on Nagarjuna as a teacher. They don't rely on the Great Perfection of Wisdom treatise as a requisite instructional guide. They use those analogous to Zhiyi's person and works, for example. So a way in which the Indian patriarchs, Nagarjuna in particular, are used to make Zhiyi now the center of Buddhist enlightenment here in China. And then similar, I think, operations are at work in the use of Ashvaghosha with his, the most famous Chinese treatise associated with him, The Awakening of Faith.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, you know, this great encapsulation of all Buddhist truth is now here in China, ready at our disposal. No need to go back to India for anything further.
Right.
And that model of doctrinal exegesis then can be followed by local Chinese masters themselves, you know, who can thereby, you know, kind of perpetuate the truth of Buddhism locally.
Mm.
And then Shenzong, the last example that's discussed in this chapter. Of course, his project is famous for, you know, by and large being all about, you know, here I'm going to make one final trip to India, bring everything back, and then we'll have it and we're done.
Yeah.
You know, the final thing, the best translations will be made. I trained under the greatest masters of the greatest Buddhist institute in Nalanda. And, you know, so now through the figure of Shenzong, all of real Indian Buddhism will be transplanted to China.
Yeah.
And that includes then in his Shiyuji, you know, the records of the Western regions, that includes all of these accounts of these Indian masters, which are interestingly and markedly different from everything that had come before in China. So then I read that as an attempt to say, you know, like, well, now we've got the real. and so that's all we need. We don't need to go any further or back into India again.
Great. So these chapters that we just discussed, 1 through 3, outline the transformations in the way in which Chinese understood these three Indian patriarchs and, you know, what the implications of changing views of the patriarchs were or are for Chinese understandings of China's relationship to India. And also, and you also use that transforming image to explore the process by which Chinese Buddhists became increasingly confident as they made Buddhism their own. Now, chapters 4 and 6, you turn to some characteristics and functions that Ashvaghosha, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva acquired, characteristics and functions that they didn't necessarily all share, but which rendered each one useful and recognizable to Chinese at both elite and popular levels. So Nagarjuna is the focus of chapter 4, and you and I think we'll skip that in the interest of time. That's where you talk about Nagarjuna in the Pure Land tradition, Nagarjuna as a sort of spell worker, and also about Nagarjuna as an alchemist. So, but I did want to I wanted to just go ahead to chapter 5, which was one of my personal favorites. And this is in which you, and chapter 5 is the one in which you look at Ashvaghosha's role as a Indian god of silkworms in sericulture.
Right.
And one of the dynamics you look at in this chapter, and you also look at this in chapter 4 and chapter 6, is the way in which the deification of these patriarchs exhibits continuity with previous images of these patriarchs found in hagiographic and exegetical literature. So it seems you're suggesting that other scholars have, well, maybe you could talk about that, how other scholars have actually argued that there were two Ashvaghoshas, and you're arguing that, no, in fact, the scholarly Ashvaghosha and Ashvaghosha as silkworm deity, these were images that appealed to both elite and popular levels.
Right, right. Well, I'm not sure exactly how or what is the logic behind the disjuncture that's posited between Ashvaghosha as an elite patriarch, and author of treatises and counselor to kings, between that image of Ashvaghosha and the image of Ashvaghosha as a silkworm god.
Mm-hmm.
It's eminently rational for us to say that these can't be the two, they can't be the same thing. I mean, clearly it can't be that a guy who wrote a text in the first century in India is also this god of silk.
Yes.
I mean, it just sort of intuitively, of course. And I think, and I assume that's behind the source in which I've seen this distinction posited. And I think the first one is in Mochizuki's, the big Buddhist encyclopedia.
Yes.
Where he's got two separate entries for Ashvaghosha. You know, there's Ashvaghosha, the patriarch, then there's Ashvaghosha, the silkworm god, which is basically like made up by illiterate peasants in Suzuki's estimation. So this split along social lines, elite and popular, then is mapped onto these two representations of Ashvaghosha as patriarch versus silkworm god. And yeah, so the sources that I'm looking at indicate to me that it's both, that Chinese authors seem to be of the mind that makes perfect sense that a guy who counseled kings and wrote treatises could also have long ago turned himself into a silkworm and saved naked horse people and therefore functions as a god of silk.
Yeah. So, sorry to interrupt. So, if I could just bring us, that's a good point to bring us actually back to silk. So I was wondering if you could just explain how it was that Ashvaghosha came to be a silkworm deity.
Well, so there's clearly a little bit of speculation involved in this part of the argument too, but it's it seems to me logical. There's a certain kind of confluence of ideas and sources that I saw as looking into it. You know, the basic idea is that from ancient times in China, there seems to have been an equivalence drawn or an analogy drawn, I guess, cosmologically, astrologically, metaphysically, perhaps, between horses and silkworms. And this is the, I guess, the part that isn't readily known. In ancient China, for various reasons, the silkworm and the horse were seen to share the same kind of qi, or the same sort of essence. There are various stories behind this regarding, let's see, how does it go? It's an astrological kind of argument for one, that during the silkworm season, when the silkworm season begins, there's a particular constellation that's at its apex in the night sky during that month. And this particular constellation is termed the heavenly team of four horses. So the horses are flying overhead at the night, the time when the sericultural season begins. There are arguments in ancient sources like Xunzi, or discussions anyway, about how the silkworm and the horse are seen to kind of look like each other. They kind of bob their head in the same way. Anyway, so there's in various ways there seem to be, in from ancient times in China, this connection between horses and silkworms. And then so it happens to be as well that Ashvaghosha's name literally means something like horse neigh. And so from early times in China and in his early hagiographies, he's variously associated with horses in some way or another, his hagiographies. His name, of course, means the neighing horse. And his name is, interestingly, it's always translated, at least not always, but almost always, it's translated into Chinese directly as Ma Ming, horse, rather than being transliterated into strings of, you know, other nonsensical syllables, as a lot of Indian names were.
Yes.
So right, just so that kind of linguistic, you know, the fact that, you know, you see his name and his name says horse, and so he's associated with horses.
Yeah.
There are also, I guess, another story that comes into play is the record of the silkworm horse from high antiquity, you know, which is, early medieval. At least in our versions of that, we've got early medieval texts, and this text also draws this connection between silkworms and horses in a way that really starts, that really seems to, what's the word? It's analogous anyway to how Ashvaghosha later becomes depicted as this silkworm sort of figure in his Baalin Zhuan hagiography, or the record of the Baalin temple, early 9th century hagiography that describes this kind of bodily metamorphosis of Ashvaghosha in the trees into a silkworm. It's speculation based on a few sources that seem to indicate how, because he's horse connected, then he gets drawn to this Chinese matrix of connections between horses and silkworms.
Yes. Could you just briefly say that one of the things I found most interesting about this chapter is the way in which the stories that you discuss, the myths, maybe we'd call them, from the record of the silk, from the record of the silkworm horse from high antiquity preserved in a 4th century redaction, and also this tradition of Baolin, a 9th century work. You talk about how the stories in there allow Buddhist justification of silkworm murder, because obviously, as you discussed, there was vehement sort of criticism of sericulture, because, you know, you have to murder silkworms by previous Buddhists. But through these stories, the silkworms come to be seen as bodhisattvas who are consciously giving up their lives in order to clothe people. Could you just kind of explain how that happens?
Yeah, I mean, I see this as being one of the major concerns that would have preoccupied Chinese Buddhists throughout their history, really. And I think maybe you'll ask about this later, but one of my next research projects concerns the relationship between Buddhism and the sericulture industry in China,
Okay.
Silk production industry. But yeah, so one of the major problems, of course, is that silk production typically requires the murder of millions of little silkworms. They're typically boiled or steamed or whatever to kill the little pupa inside of the cocoon, such that it doesn't break out of the cocoon and destroy the silk. The silk kind of has to all be unwound in a single thread for it to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, killing lots of silkworms was required for the silk industry. And then you have, Buddhists kind of living in the land of silk. I mean, silk's just everywhere. It's money. There's sericulture production is everywhere. It's a major basis for trade, diplomatic relations. It's a major commodity that's donated to the Sangha, to monastic communities. Silk is just everywhere in China. And of course, it is a murderous enterprise. And you see a lot of sources in medieval China where this very complaint is made.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do about that as a Buddhist in medieval China? And you can't, obviously you can't, though some do. I think the overwhelming response from the Buddhist institution could not be one of railing against sericulture. It's just everywhere, deeply ingrained in Chinese culture.
Yes.
So then I see this potentially as one kind of Buddhist response to that problem, which is to, as you said, to make silkworms different kinds of creatures, and therefore make their killing a different kind of act.
Mm-hmm.
They are in this context great, compassionate bodhisattvas themselves, gladly giving up their lives for the salvation of others. And so the killing of them then is not, this wanton murder, but it's enabling bodhisattva vows. So it's a certain kind of on the basis of Mahayana ethics, upaya and such, it's a certain kind of Buddhist justification for silk production.
Mm-hmm.
This is really my interpretation of the hagiography of Ashvaghosha in the Baolin Zhuan. And so it's speculative too. I don't know that hagiography was necessarily interpreted as such, but
yes,
it does lend itself to that, and it does definitely depict silkworms as great little bodhisattvas.
Yes,
which would seem to have important implications for what it meant to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the next step of the argument is similar to what I was describing from the earlier chapters, but now it depicts this text now depicts sericulture. As having been invented in ancient India long before Buddhism's, this is like Ashvaghosha's past life, so it doesn't give you a real clear timeline, but long
mm-hmm.
ago,
mm-hmm.
Silk production was invented by a great bodhisattva in India. So it renders the entire sericulture enterprise Indian Buddhist.
Mm.
So then I work to interpret that similarly in a kind of a socio-political way of increasing patronage for Buddhist institutions, providing a certain kind of sovereignty over the Buddhist institution over silkworms, silk production, and then especially in the ritual arena or the religious ritual divine dimensions of the silk industry, which were long-standing ancient in China. Silk production always required the use of deities and rituals, rites to ensure healthy silkworms and abundant crops. It always did everywhere from ancient times in China. And so mm-hmm. I see this as a way for Buddhists to kind of like, it's an entree for the Buddhist institution, for Buddhist deities, for Buddhist rituals in this world of sericulture religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that. So we're getting near the end of the interview. But I want to mention to listeners that besides not covering chapter 4, there's also an extremely interesting chapter 6 in which you sort of tie some of the arguments that you've made throughout the book together and make some further arguments about the way in which these three Indian patriarchs were able to bridge the divide between sort of ancient India and latter-day China. And you also just address a question that some listeners or readers might have, which is, how did these three Indian Buddhist patriarchs differ from other Indian holy figures who are, coming into China with Buddhism, such as celestial bodhisattvas and arhats and whatnot? But I also want to note for the listeners that the book also contains three appendices and also the Chinese characters in the text itself, which was very helpful. And also it's footnotes, not endnotes, which is very nice. So we've taken a lot of your time, but as a final question, I just wanted to ask if there's something that you're working on at the moment. You alluded to this, you referred to the Silkworm project a bit earlier.
Right, right. Yeah, so the next research project that I'm trying to develop, hopefully is a second book, is the relationships between the Buddhist institution and the Chinese silk industry. Against the backdrop of broader Chinese conceptions of sericulture and civilization, the silk being kind of a fundamental gift for all of humanity by the ancient sage kings and the silkworm being valued as such, as providing this great commodity that, provides really one of the foundations for human life, as a lot of ancient Chinese sources will depict the industry and, the whole pantheon of very important silk gods and goddesses and founding figures and so on. It's sort of a very central and important aspect of Chinese civilization, society, and philosophy. How does the Buddhist institution relate to this? So to me, it seems to be one important question. These two monoliths, really, of Chinese industry and of Chinese religion, and how do they relate to one another in various ways, ritually and philosophically, doctrinally, socially, politically, and economically, especially. So this is the broad topic and some of the dimensions that I'm trying to get at concerning it. What I'm working on next.
Oh, great. We'll look forward to that. So, that is going to be it for today. So I just want to thank you again so much for speaking with me. And I also wanted to thank our listeners for tuning in. That's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.